Okay, good evening everyone, and welcome to Term 4, Session 6, which is the end of Term 4. And last time we completed the seventh Perek of Megillas Esther. And it was quite a moment. And we had Achashverosh go out into the palace garden during the second party. And during that time, Haman went and approached Esther. I don't think we discussed just what it is he said to her during that time. And he knew, we did discuss that there's no point speaking to the king, because the king will remember when they went out to the palace garden, that was just the place where he organized the execution for Vashti. So he didn't want to go into the king to the same place because he didn't want to bring up bad memories. So he thought, my only chance here is to appeal to the queen. Maybe she'll get me off the hook. So what did he say? It says that he went and stood up and he begged Queen Esther for his life, because he saw that trouble had overtaken him from the king. That was the pasuk. So Haman thought, there's no doubt if I go after him into the palace garden, it'll be reflections of Vashti, which is something Esther has already mentioned. So what did he say? He says, listen to me. It was me who made you queen, and I orchestrated Vashti's execution, and that allowed you to take center stage. You've got to understand that since I had only your interests in mind, I never intended to buy you. I never even knew you were Jewish. Now, this, of course, was a weak ploy. He had no interest in Esther in mind at all, and that was very, very clear to everyone. But he did give it a go. But it was a very, half-hearted stab at an impossible situation. And just as he was speaking to her, we know that the Malach came and threw him onto Esther as King Ahasuerus came back in. And when that happened, that was it. It was curtains, literally. And they hanged Haman on the very gallows which he had prepared for Mordechai. Yes. Very good. I would have forgotten about it again this week as well. But I did say at the end of last week that I would make some comparisons between Haman and Yosef, and I forgot to do that last time. So, in order to make up for lost ground, let's just have a quick look at some interesting corollaries between Haman and Yosef. Now, Haman was a rasha. In fact, he called Haman Hara Hazeh, this Haman. He was actually called Haman Hara by Esther last week. And Yosef was known as Yehosef HaTzadik, Joseph the Righteous, specifically for his withholding of himself in the test of Zuleika Aishas Potiphar. So as Yosef was a tzaddik, Haman was a rosha. And everything that happened to Haman happened for the good, while everything that happened to Yosef happened for evil. Let me explain. Haman was sold to slavery. As we learned, he was a general, and he had to sell himself for loaves of bread to who? To Mordechai. Yosef at tzaddik became a slave sold to those who were evil, the Ishmaelites, the Midianites, and they sold him on the slave trade to Potiphar, and he became enslaved to Potiphar. That's an interesting difference. So we see Yosef was enslaved to evil people, Haman was enslaved to good people. They were both involved in a banquet where there was eating of bread. Haman was involved, obviously, in a banquet of eating of bread, and that was in order to be able to enhance his position so he could fall in the hands of Mordechai and Esther, while Yosef at Tzadik was also involved in a banquet. And remember, he turned round to his master's wife, said, "Everything is permitted to me except for eating of bread." That's what he said to her. That's an interesting, we see Rashi on that. He specifically utilized the idea of eating bread. They were both seen as opposite of who they were. Haman HaRosha was seen as a tremendously good person who was fantastic for media, and King Ahasuerus was nothing short of smitten with him. While Yosef HaTzadik was actually seen as a degenerate, a criminal, and was thrown into jail, while he was actually purely righteous. He was completely seen the opposite of who he was. They were both accused of znus. They were both accused of immorality. Haman Harosha fell upon Esther completely. It was not his fault at all. And a malach threw him onto her in order to be able to get him arrested and eventually killed, where he didn't do anything wrong. Yosef, too, was falsely accused of znus. In no way was it his fault. And this way, it ended up evil. He got thrown into prison for this. While Haman getting killed was actually a good thing. It actually was good for the Jews. Yosef getting thrown into prison was ostensibly not good for the Jews. Both were rushed quickly to their positions. Haman was very quickly promoted, as we learned out the whole thing with the Muchen being Haman and Vashti. And then he was promoted above all the other seven wise ministers. And he kept getting promoted and promoted and promoted, and then more things with Bigson and Seresh, more things were given to him, like everyone had to bow and prostrate themselves to him. Very quick promotion. Yosef was rushed out of prison, given a haircut and a change of clothing. Then he was interpreting dreams of Pharaoh. That very same day, he became viceroy of all of Egypt, which was the superpower in the world at the time. So very interesting thing. Yosef HaTzadik was quickly rushed up into a position in order to be able to organize the Jews' benefit, to make sure they would have food when they come from Eretz Kanaan, and to make sure they've got a Jewish environment, while Haman was rushed up in order to be an enemy of the Jews. And God always builds up the Jews' enemy to give them power. In fact, that's one of the main things that we learn out. If you want to become great in the world, raise up against Klal Yisrael. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes you great in order to beat Klal Yisrael with you. Those are some fascinating concepts of the link between Haman and Yosef. But now what we're going to do is jump into the eighth perek. And I'd like to look at the first two psukim as a block, if that's possible. We're going to do B'yom Hahu. Now, the question, obviously, that we're going to have to address here is, why do we need the words B'yom Hahu? What's so going on about on this particular day? Nosan Mel Chashrosh le'Esther Hamalka, es Beis Haman. So what happened? King Chashrosh awarded the estate of Haman to Esther. And he was Tzara HaYehudim. He was the adversary of the Jews. And he gave all of his estate over to Queen Esther. And Mordechai approached the king, because Esther had revealed his relationship to her. Now, we need to discuss what that means. It's the first time that we see Mordechai re-entering the scene at this particular point. So this is a re-entering of Mordechai. Why is he popping up here? What does it mean now the relationship has been revealed? What's happening? Verse 2, V'yasar HaMelech, and this is important, he removed also, notice, the signet ring that Haman had taken. Also, Yosef was given the signet ring of Pharaoh. Pharaoh placed the signet ring into Yosef's hand and said, you know, this is everything. I only outrank you by the throne. So to Achashrosh gave the special signet ring to Haman, said, do what you want with the Jews. We see one's very much opposite the other. The king removed his signet ring, which had taken from Haman, and he gave it to Mordechai. And Esther placed Mordechai in charge of Haman's estate. So we do see that Achashrosh gave Haman's estate to Esther as a personal gift. And it was Esther that gave that to Mordechai. Now, at the end of the previous chapter, 7:10, when they hanged Haman on the gallows, the 50-cubit gallows, we wrote that the king's fury subsided. That's what the Pasuk says, the king's fury has calmed down. Now, what's interesting is that God's, Mordechai's, and Esther's fury over Israel's distress had not yet abated, but Achashrosh's distress over Haman had. Why is that? That's because the decree to annihilate the Jews was still very much in force. Yes, the head of the snake had been removed, but the snake was very much wiggling about and posing a significant danger to Klal Israel. The only way that we could get the Jews off the hook was if God himself gets involved to abrogate Haman's letters, which have already been sent out to all and sundry, and we've got a problem. We've got a problem in the fact that the decree, the internal memo, and the decrees, the public notices, are all over the whole known world. Now, Achashrosh maintained that according to Median and Persian law, the decree was irrevocable. That was it. It's been signed. It's out. There's nothing he can do. But you guys, Esther and Mordechai, I had no idea, you know, just how much I owed you. And I'm very, very sorry. And, you know, we're on good terms now. But what can I do? You know, let bygones be bygones. We're just going to have to destroy the Jews anyway. But when Ahasuerus executed Haman, the king's intention was to save only Esther, right? Though even this action was against the royal constitution, saving Esther was still illegal because technically he could be taken to court because he could say, excuse me, Esther's Jewish. And you've already made an irrevocable decree saying all Jews have to die. And your wife is Jewish. Okay, I got Esther off the hook by this special clemency and the fact that we didn't know she was Jewish in the Mekach Tais. It was a failed, you know, maybe I'll wangle Esther out legally. But I can't save all the Jews. That's what it means, Beyom Hahu. On that day that King Ahasuerus gave the estate of Haman to Queen Esther, it says like this, Queen Esther, since she was Queen Esther, the king didn't give her anything. He didn't have to give her anything because she already possessed everything. What would she want with Haman's estate? Haman was still the adversary of the Jews. That's why the verse does not say he had been the adversary of the Jews. He is. He is the adversary of the Jews actively. It's present tense. That's because these letters are still active and the Jews are still going to be killed at Haman's word. Now, the decree that Haman made was still in effect. And according to Median law, any decree that's signed and sealed with a royal signet ring, which had been given to him by Ahasuerus, is now irrevocable. So in order to demonstrate that Esther is not included, Ahasuerus gave her Haman's estate as if to say Esther has now dispossessed Haman. And she's got dominion over him, and she was never included in the original sale. That's why the king gave her this estate on that day, Bayom Hahu, specifically on the day when Haman was hanged, to make sure to put fear into the Jews' enemies' hearts to say, Esther's got nothing to do with it. I've got Esther off by giving her Haman's estate. It's clear that there's no way Esther is in this decree. Now, when it says Mordechai approached the king, although the decree against the Jews had not yet been stopped, Mordechai felt he could approach the king because Esther had revealed his relationship to her. Now, it's only later in verse 2 that the king removed the signet ring which had been taken from Haman and gave it to Mordechai. Right? Why? Because he said he wanted to prevent the enemies from harming Mordechai. And when they see the signet ring on his hand, they won't touch him. So King Ahasuerus transferred Haman's power to Mordechai. And that ring which facilitated the sale of the Jews to Haman had now been given to Mordechai. And that's how Ahasuerus is going to reward Mordechai. And that's how he's changing his mind about Mordechai by giving him the ring. So how does he get Esther off the hook? He gives her Haman's estate. How does he get Mordechai off the hook? He gives Mordechai the ring he gave to Haman. Those two act as a patur, as an exemption certificate, to say these two Jews aren't included in the internal and external memo. They're safe. Okay, so that's what we've got so far. So far we've got Mordechai and Esther off the hook, but we don't have anybody else off the hook. Now, the king's exempting Mordechai from the decree was still not publicly known. That's why Esther placed Mordechai in charge of Haman's estate. Do you see? As far as Mordechai knows, he's got the signet ring. So when people come up to kill him in the street, being a Jew, they'll have to flash the ring to every single assailant. Okay, that'll help him. Esther didn't want that for him. Esther's now got Haman's estate. So she gave Haman's estate to Mordechai. She gave Haman's estate to Mordechai. And in so doing, it was as public an act as the way Ahasuerus gave Haman's estate to Esther, so that nobody would harm Mordechai from the outset. Now, Esther put Mordechai in charge of Haman's estate in order to save the Jews who were in Shushan. She had a bigger plan. Now, she knew throughout the kingdom the order to annihilate had not been expressed explicitly. It was an internal memo, if you remember from the third perek. And the third perek, I think it's 3:14, says the decree that says only should be ready on that day. That was the public notice. Just be ready on that day. But the edict did not reveal that the intent was to destroy the Jews. That objective was only made clear in the internal memo that we discussed, that was to the province mayors and leaders, and that was kept secret until the appointed day by Haman to make sure they didn't miss the actual Purim day, which is the day that Haman chose as most auspicious because of Moshe Rabbeinu's death and the end of his Shiva, right? 7 days after Zion Adar. But in Shushan itself, it was straightforward to destroy the Jews. And that's why, in order to instill the fear of God into all the non-Jews in Shushan, who hadn't been privy to the internal memo, Esther took a public stand by placing Mordechai in charge of Haman's estate. So therefore, the Goyim would never dare raise up against the Jews, and that instilled fear in them, and that was necessary because the decree that non-Jews were taunting, just remember we learnt that the Jew would go to the shops, and the guy behind the shop says, today I'm going to take your money for the fish that I'm selling you, so I'm going to slit your throat and take all your money at home. That's what they would say to all the women that were going to the shop. Can't wait to throttle you to death. They definitely knew what was going on. When Mordechai got placed publicly by Queen Esther in charge of Haman's estate, that changed things in the Goyish mind. They were like, maybe what we understood as this public notification stroke hid memo that we were privy to was actually wrong. First of all, Esther and Mordechai have been greatly promoted and Haman is dead. Maybe things aren't happening. Now, if you remember back to 416, remember when Mordechai told Esther, you got to go in there, you got to do this, and this is what you have to do. You know, there's no question, you just got to get it done. And she says, if I die, I die. You know, I'll do it. I'll listen to what you have to say. I don't agree with it. I think I should wait until 30 days have elapsed. You're telling me to go in early. What was the reason for that? Because he said, you know, you've got to save Shevet Binyamin. And if you don't do it now, Moshe Rabbeinu will do it. So you've got to act right away. And so she said, fine, you know, this could kill me. And if I die, I die. She was willing to give up her life in this. Esther said to Mordechai that she, if she would perish, as it were, she'd perish from him. Why? You see, until then, this is really important. Esther has just revealed her relationship to Mordechai. What did she say to Ahasuerus? It's not clear. Esther would rise up from sleeping with Ahasuerus and go to a mikveh and return to Mordechai. Now, whereas previously she had been coerced into being with Ahasuerus and therefore could always never be considered culpable halachically, now she's culpable since she's been with the king voluntarily. She is forbidden to her husband Mordechai from here on in. That's why we can understand the words, Esther had revealed his relationship to her. What does that mean? That Al-Shech HaKadosh says, Esther told only about her present relationship to Mordechai. That is, she was his uncle's daughter, but not that Mordechai had actually been her husband, because from here on in, she's forbidden to him. So there's no point telling Ahasuerus about this. This is quite important piece of information. So her status to Mordechai at this point has now changed. Okay, now also on that day, King Ahasuerus gave the estate of Haman to Queen Esther, but not on any other day, B'yom Ha'u. That means because Haman was the adversary of the Jews, the king now internally felt bad that Haman had actually almost harmed or killed his beloved wife and Mordechai, his kind of seeming political friend. So to demonstrate his change of heart, the king gave Haman's entire estate to Esther. Now, had Haman been hanged only in retaliation for his evil designs against Ahasuerus, then all of Haman's wealth would have been taken by the king into his purse. It would go to the royal coffers. If he was just high treasonous against Ahasuerus, he'd take his estate and own it himself. What does it mean, Bayom Ahu? Ahasuerus deviated from that protocol of saying all to the crown, and he gave the estate to Haman. He took the estate from Haman to Esther, and that showed that Haman was executed dafka because of his evil intent against Esther, rather than Ahasuerus. Because Haman was the adversary of the Jews, stroke Esther, Ahasuerus gave Haman's wealth to Esther to make amends. It's got nothing to do with me, says Ahasuerus. He wanted to kill you and I didn't know that. I feel really bad about that. To prove that, you know, I've got no bad feelings, I'll give you his money as some kind of compensation. Now Mordechai approached the king, not because he had spoken good for the king, but because Esther had revealed his relationship to her. For Esther's sake, the king removed his signet ring, saving Mordechai and all those enemies that would seek to enforce the evil decree, because now he realized, if Mordechai is indeed Esther's uncle, and he gets killed in the melee that's about to happen in Shushan, which he was fully aware about and didn't want to stop. He goes, I feel bad for Esther. Now she's going to lose her uncle. She'll be distraught and she'll blame me for it. So I'll give the signet ring to Mordechai, cover him. I'm all doing it for Esther. As far as Ahasuerus is concerned, everything he's doing is doing for Esther. It's only to make amends for Esther for what has happened with Haman. So far, so good. Let's now look at 3, 4, 5, and 6 as a block. Now, there's quite a lot here. Tosef Esther v'tadaber lifnei hamelech. That's very interesting. So, first of all, she spoke. One is tadaber. V'tipol. And she fell lifonai roglav, in front of the king's feet. That's type 2. So, speaking is one. Falling in front of the king's feet is type 2. V'tefk. V'tachnein loy. And she implored him. She cried out. That is type 3 and 4. Crying and imploring. Four different types of subjugation she showed to Ahasuerus immediately. So what's just happened? He's given Esther Haman's estate and he's taken Haman's ring and given it to Mordechai. As soon as that happens, she falls down on the ground, literally grabbing the king's feet, wailing in four different ways. Four different ways. What's going on here? It's all very well. Essentially, think about it from their perspective. This doesn't look very good. This doesn't look very good. The situation right now in 8:3 looks, I'd say, pretty horrendous. The only people who are doing well right now are Esther and Mordechai. Essentially, Haman is saying, look, I'll look after you two, but your brethren, they're going to get killed. You two will survive the Holocaust. This is horrendous news, and it doesn't go anywhere to fixing up Shevet Binyamin either. If all the Jews get killed, you can't say Mordechai and Esther have done a great job saving up, you know, Shevet Binyamin. So let's have a look. So she fell before his feet and cried, imploring him to avert the evil of Haman the Agagite and his scheme which he had plotted against the Jews. So now they are arguing for all Jews in the world, essentially. Now, what happened? The king stretched out the golden scepter, second time that's happened, and Esther arose and stood before the king. That was always a sign of divine mercy from him, that he was feeling good towards you. And she said, second time that she's said this now kind of words, if it pleases the king, and I found favour before him, if the matter is proper before the king, and I am good in his eyes. Now, careful here. Then let an edict be written to revoke the letters. Now, what does that mean? Well, this really means, does not mean to make a second decree saying don't listen to the first one. Make a second decree to say give me all the letters back. Go around to 127 provinces and ask for the memos back. The original plan of Haman, separate idea, son of Hamadasar the Agagite, who wrote to destroy the Jews who were in all the king's provinces. Now, that word destroy was in the public notice. It's very, ambiguous. What does that mean? Does that mean take away their money? Does it mean take away their pride? Does it mean make them lowly? Does it mean to actually physically kill them? Very unclear. It was only in the internal memo that was spelled out in, you know, explicitly. Verse 6, for how can I bear to see the evil which will happen to my people? It's all very well you're saving me, but you'll destroy my life if you kill my brethren. And how can I bear to see the destruction of my kinsmen? Ooh, who's her kinsmen if she's already said her people? She's already said the destruction of my people. How can I see the war kinsmen? What is she talking about? Now, first, Haman thought only to destroy the Jews. That means specifically, as we said in 3:9, plunder their property, which is what people kind of understood by that word anyway. That's why he said to the king, let an edict be written to destroy them, i.e. destroy their influence and wealth. But when Haman saw that Ahasuerus was actually quite pleased to do whatever Haman wished and even more, he was like, yeah, it sounds really good. In 3:11, chapter 3, verse 11, the king said to Haman, the silver is given to you. These 10,000 talents you've offered me, I'll refund you. And also the people to do with as you please. You know, you can knock yourself out with it. I don't care. You can do what you want with them. That's why Haman felt free to propagate an evil plan far more intense than just merely destroy their property. And that's why he dictated an internal memo saying, one, to destroy, two, to murder, and three, to annihilate. And we said specifically had the cruel manifesto of murdering the children in front of the parents. He said to Mordechai, the kids will be the first ones I kill, because it was the children who gave Mordechai solace by telling him that Altir Mipachad Pesukim, the three Pesukim that we saw after Aleinu, says, wow, yeah, you're so happy about what the kids are telling you? Wait, I'll slaughter them in front of their parents first, and then I'll kill their parents. Right? So that then became something he wanted to do specifically, way beyond merely knocking the Jews down a peg. Now, Haman used a non-specific term, destroy, which could be people plundering possessions. And when he saw that the king was allowing him free hand, he personally added murder and annihilate onto that. Now, Esther was concerned that her request would remove only one or two of these elements. Maybe the king would say, look, I can help you with one or two, but I can't completely remove the decree. But certainly not all of them. And she was scared that although the king might agree to rescind three of the evils, destroy, murder, and annihilate, Ahasuerus would still retain the original order, which was destroy as in plunder the Jews' wealth. That's why she spoke and fell before his feet and cried and implored. Each one of these particular things which is recorded, the Medrash explains, is trying to negate one of the different types of decrees that are against the Jews at the moment. The first three expressions correspond to the three elements to destroy, to murder, and annihilate. So spoke, fell, and cry are against destroy, murder, and annihilate. But then when she implored beyond that, that goes back to Haman's original decree to knock down the Jews anyway. So at that point, the king was overcome by mercy when he saw Esther literally on the ground, wailing by holding his ankles, begging him for clemency. And this was the wife that he now loved in place of Vashti. He extended the golden scepter, and that showed favor. And that gesture demonstrated he had chen for her. He had grace for her, and that life would be granted to her. Because just like if you extend the scepter in the 30 days before you got there, that means life would be granted you as opposed to death. And that indicates that Esther was going to be permitted to arise from the ground. And that's why it says Esther arose and stood before the king. Now, we got some worries here. It's not plain sailing. The king had a change of heart and he wants to do good. And he feels bad for the mess that he's made by getting Esther into this awful, awful trouble, which he obviously had no idea about. Okay, Bavakashal. But we've got a problem. I can't help you. There are laws. There are laws in my land. And if a decree is sealed with the king's signet ring, that's it. I don't know what you want me to do. So that's why I asked you in chapter 5, verse 6, what is your request and what is your petition regarding this party? Why do you want us to turn up? If you ask for up to half the kingdom, it'll be granted. Now, the Gemara Megillah that we discussed and Tes Vav Omad Beis, that's 15b, said the king was offering half, but not all. Why is that? Why couldn't he offer her two thirds? Why dafka half? What's going on with, look, you know, enough is enough. He said like this, what he was really afraid of, says the Gemara Megillah, was that Esther might ask him for the restoration of the Beis HaMikdash. And that would be equivalent to more than half of his kingdom. And that's why it's possible that the king refused to revoke the edict against the Jews, which is a favour which was worth more than half the kingdom. I can't let all the Jews live because I told you up to half the kingdom I'll give you. But you allow me to keep all the Jews going and they'll build the Beis HaMikdash, I can't have that. My whole glory is basically just being destroyed. And it's not going to be rebuilt. I was very scared about that. I'd miscalculated 70 years. That's why I'd made a big feast. I don't know if you remember that. That was already way back when, you know. That's why we had the big party. That's why Esther repeated the four requests to the king, if it pleases the king, and I have found favor before him, and the matter is proper before the king, and I am good in his eyes. Notice those four again. Those correspond to the three elements of Haman's evil decree, destroy, murder, annihilate, and his original intention in chapter 3, verse 9, let an edict be written to destroy them in the first place. So she's reiterating, I've got to undo the whole thing. So here's, I don't know what to tell you. So she said, I've got a plan. She says, let an edict be written to revoke the original letters. Now remember, two different letters were set. See how everything is like, chapter 8, 9 and 10 is just tying up everything we've learned in the previous chapters. You've got to have a hold on the material that we've done earlier to see how everything ties up at the end here. We had the internal memo and the external public notice, right? Now, the internal memo was explicit, but the public declaration, which meant to everywhere but Shushan, was essentially extremely vague. And they didn't, it just said, be ready on that day. For what? You know what? Nudge, 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 wink, wink. The second version was a letter sent to the ministers of every town and prophets. That was an internal memo. And that was the explicit order to destroy, murder, and annihilate the Jews. That was chapter 3, verse 13. Now, that order had to be kept secret until the appointed day because Haman was scared that people would rush to kill the Jews earlier in their virulent anti-Semitism that he knew there was and to get their money, losing the potency of the death of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is why they had to wait for almost a year to get this done. Esther thought media and Persian law dictates that any edict issued by the king cannot be revoked because that was the case regarding Darius the Mede, who was the father of Ahasuerus, and that's been learnt out from Daniel 6:16. And she learnt that from a man called Daniel, who was her advisor before he had been killed, assassinated by Haman. Daniel said, we ain't going to be able to undo this decree. I know the law from Ahasuerus' father. You are not going to be able to undo this decree now that it's been sealed. So what did she say? She said, I understand. You can't go back on your original edict. I get that. That's law and it would slight you. I get that. That would be a disgrace. Rather, here's a plan. Order that the ministers return the letters which you sent them. And on the appointed day of the edict's execution, when the masses raise an outcry, demanding to know what they've all got to be ready for, the letters explaining the particulars of the decree won't be there. And that's how salvation will come about. You keep your first decree going. That's fine. Just make a new decree to gather in all the internal memos through 126 out of the 127, not including Shushan, provinces. By the way, this is why we split up Purim to Shushan Purim. The experience of the Jews in Shushan was very different to the experience of the Jews outside of Shushan. The Jews in Shushan knew what was potting. So did the Goyim. And they weren't going to be easily assuaged. The Jews and the Gentiles outside of Shushan simply weren't as clued up as to what was going on unless you were a minister who had viewed the internal memo. Nobody really knew what was happening. Ezra's saying, go and get all those internal memos back. That means when they say the day's ready, we don't know what the day's ready for. It's been a year. I don't know what it was all about. I don't know. Some kind of like nonsense that was like, you know, when the king said, you know, every man should be chief in his house after Vashti disgraced him. Nobody will know. That's why she said the ministers won't reveal the contents of the internal memo and the king's honour will not be lost because the edict was never revoked. Rather, a new one was made where the letters are returned and their content will never be known. We'll keep it confidential for your eyes only. There's nothing that's happened. Nothing has gone wrong. So when Esther said to revoke the letters, she didn't mean undo the decree. She just said, bring them back. Now, can we jump ahead? We've not done the Pasuk, but are in 8:8. Can we jump to 8:8, if you don't mind? I know that I've missed a couple of Pasukim, we'll get there. And you should write concerning the Jews whatever you please in the king's name and seal it with the royal signet ring. For a text which was written in the king's name and sealed with a royal signet ring cannot be revoked. So what's he saying? Not only is it impossible to revoke an edict which has been issued by the king, it's even impossible to have a text returned to me, even though it's not common knowledge. This is horrendous legal news. Esther had a very clever idea. The idea was just write a second letter saying, bring me back all the first letters. We're not undoing the original decree. We're just making a new one. And both stay. Says Ahasuerus, yeah, clever. I get the plan. But you don't understand that you haven't understood the paradigm of the law quite right. One is you can't undo a decree that's been written and sealed in the ring. Two is once it's sealed and sent, there can be no revocation of the letter even being brought back. It's out in the wind. That's it. It can't come back. So Ahasuerus himself seems to be wanting to help Esther, but saying, look, what can I do? I'm not going to break the law. Finally, Esther said, the Pesukim that we've just read, about Haman who wrote to destroy the Jews who were in all the king's provinces. She was hoping to prevent the king from saying, I'll grant you half the kingdom but not all of the Jews who are spared throughout more than half of my kingdom. The Jews are scattered all over the place and I'm only willing to grant you half the kingdom. And the Jews are more than half of my kingdom. So she said, the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. Now it's interesting, if you look at 3:9, when Haman spoke to the king regarding the edict, he said, let an edict be written to destroy them. But later, Haman dictated the text saying to destroy, murder and annihilate. So Esther was now concerned that before Haman had changed the text, a version of the letter containing the original scheme only to destroy had been released to one of the provinces. Now, if that was the case, Esther had asked the king to return merely the letters which just said destroy, murder and annihilate. I'm only interested in the internal memos. I only want the internal memos back. I don't mind the public notices, but at least gather me the internal memos. Anything that is explicit, I want back. And Esther added the plan of Haman, referring Dafka to his original thought. Kol Shekain, all the more so she meant to destroy and annihilate. That should be, if you're not going to take back the public notice, at least take back the internal memo. Now, when it says a decree that was to destroy, murder and annihilate, Esther said, how can I bear to see the evil which will happen to my people? What does that mean? The king might have said to Esther, I don't agree to Haman's edict to destroy, murder and annihilate, but only to his original idea to destroy, which is to steal all the Jews' property. That's why Esther's saying, how can I bear to see the evil which will happen to my people? Even if you don't murder, destroy and annihilate, at least you're going to be leaving them impoverished. That's horrendous. How can you do that to an entire nation? Don't think that my people's plight won't affect me just because I'm in the palace. My very salvation and that of my father's house depends upon my people's salvation through my hands, says Esther. This matter has been explained. What did we talk about in 4:14? Notice when Esther was balking Mordechai's idea. Mordechai said, you've got to go in before 30 days have passed. This is it. And she said, that is not a clever move, right? That's not a clever move. He'll kill me. And what good will there be in that? And he, mummish, slammed down that approach. He said, if you keep silent at a time like this, relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from another place, while you and your father's house will perish. What was he saying to her? If you keep silent now, you'll be silent later when someone else gets the job done without you. Who's the someone else? Moshe Rabbeinu. I'm telling you, there's a ruach, there's a spirit which will organize this. That's what he said. He was alluding to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is davening upstairs on behalf of Klal Yisrael. If he saves the day, you and I from Shevet Binyamin will never be able to be Matakan Shevet Binyamin, fix up the sin of Shevet Binyamin because of Sha'ul. This whole mess was because of Sha'ul. Had he have not led the king of Agag, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him, live overnight, and he did, and then they sired all the way through that Haman, this whole problem, it's our fault. You've got to go in there and you've got to risk your life, because if you don't do it, it'll get done by Shevet Levi and that'll be useless for Shevet Binyamin. That's why she says, my people and my kinsmen. She's saying, look, first of all, I've got to save the Jews. You can't do that to me, you know, mate. Two is, I've got to... Esther is related to Mordechai. He's my uncle and he's an Ishimini. He's a Benjaminite. and I'm a Benjaminite. And we have a special thing that we are asking of you from Shevet Benjamin, that you save the Jews, because I personally need to save Benjamin with my hands. This is my destiny. I'm willing to give up my whole life only to do this. She said that. If I die, I die. If I have to live with you for the rest of my life, I'll do it. But you've got to let me at least save Shevet Benjamin. That's what it means. That's why she said, my people and my kinsmen. She says, this is key. Let's look at verses 7 through 14. Through 14 is a block. So the king Ahasuerus said to Esther, the queen, and to Mordechai the Jew, who's now re-entered the story because Esther's brought him back in, as we learnt out at the beginning of the 8th parak. Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and they hanged him on the gallows because he cast his hand against the Jews. I've done my bit. We did verse 8, but I'll do it again. And you shall write concerning the Jews whatever you please in the king's name. You can try it and seal it with a royal signet ring, for a text which was written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring cannot be revoked. You can try it. So the king, now listen to this. This is where the actual action starts at actually moving to revoke those original letters. The king's scribes were summoned at that time on the 23rd of the third month, which is the month of Sivan. And it was written according to everything that Mordechai commanded the Jews. Whoever was holding the ring seems to have command. Haman had the ring, he had command of the scribes. Now Mordechai has the ring, he's got command of the scribes. As Mordechai commanded the Jews and the officials, the governors and the ministers who had a copy of the gruesome internal memo of the provinces from Hurdu to Kush, from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, each province in its own script, as we discussed, why was that? To give chashivas and that every to give importance to each cultural segment of the kingdom, and also that everyone should understand it properly. Each people in its own language. Remember, Mordechai could speak all these languages, so he could dictate it in each language. And to the Jews in their own script and their own language. The Jews have got to be in on this. He wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus to give it power and sealed it with a king's signet ring to make it irrevocable. And he sent letters through courier on horseback. Riders of swift mules bred from mares. Do I really need to know that? Stating that the king had permitted the Jews of every single town to assemble and defend their lives, to destroy, murder, and annihilate every armed force of any people or province which attacks them, including their children and women, and to plunder their booty. There's a misinformation red flag going up here. Yes, remember that thing about murder, destroy, and annihilate? I'm actually staging mass anarchy. You can raise up against the Jews, but the Jews can raise up against you. Now it's a free-for-all. On one day, throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, an extract of the text of these letters was to be posted as law throughout every province and publicized to all the peoples, stating that the Jews should be ready, not the Goyim, to avenge themselves upon their enemies. Now that doesn't mean that the Goyim can't raise up and try to plunder the Jews. The first decree is still active. But now everybody, Jew and Gentile, knows that the King Ahasuerus has waived any death penalty or any crime against the Jews fighting back. Wow, that is pretty intense. Look at verse 14. The couriers, riders of swift mules, went out, Mavoy Holim, stunned, Udchufim, literally Dachuf means urgently, swiftly, a pressing need is Dachuf, it's urgent, in haste, by order of the king, and the law was enacted in Shushan, the capital. Shushan's different because the goyim already knew what was meant to be happening. The Jews already knew what was going to be happening. So the changeover outside of Shushan was really extreme. Remember, if you were living, I don't know, in Basingstoke or something like that, completely outside of Shushan, all you knew was you've got to be ready on that day. And nobody really knew what that meant. There was rumours maybe we're going to rise up against the Jews, it's going to be like a Kristallnacht. But nobody really knew. Now it's explicit to everybody in Basingstoke that everyone who wants to rise, every Jew who wants to rise up against the Gentile, who wants to harm them, they can do. Which is a very big shock, but still very much fits in with the idea, be ready on that day. So they're essentially none the wiser. Now they're just being clued up to something brand new. If you were in Shushan, things were very different. They knew that the day was set in Adar to kill all the Jews. And now a new thing is coming out saying the Jews can fight you back. That means the Jews and the Gentiles in Shushan had a very different experience of what was going on versus the Jews outside of Shushan. It's a different kind of Purim. Now, first, two versions of the edict were dispatched. One was explicit, internal memo, and the other one was a general public notice. But in Shushan, the law had been enacted expressly to destroy the Jews. And that's what we said in 4:8, an extract of the text of the law which was enacted in Shushan and that they were commanded to destroy them. Shushan was different. In town, in London Central, right, they knew this is what was going to be happening. Now, because the people of Shushan knew the order was to destroy the Jews, Mordechai and Esther were forced to have a special announcement made in Shushan, stating what? That the Jews should be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Now, without such an announcement, the Jewish inhabitants might have been in incredibly grave danger, because everybody absolutely knew what was going on the 13th of Adar. But even after this special announcement, the Jews of Shushan are still in danger, because the Goyim have got the ability to raise up. They'll say like this, they'll have a legal argument. Once it's sealed in the king's signet, which it was with Haman the first time round, we've got to kill the Jews on the 13th and 14th of Adar, which we've got to do anyway. Now all that we're being told is Mordechai saying they can kill us too. Essentially, full-scale anarchy is going to hit Shushan. Now, the Gentiles outside of Shushan in Basingstoke, they don't really exactly know what's going on. All they really know now is the Jews can take up arms and they'll get away with whatever they want, which frankly puts the Gentiles in more danger than the Jews. But in Shushan, it just means open war. For one day, no punishment, it's open war. So it's not safe in Shushan. The Persians accepted the argument. Thousands of Gentiles might have attacked the Jews, who may have been unable to defend themselves, and many Jews might have died if it wasn't for this special announcement. Now what's changed is the Gentiles have to think twice, because there's absolutely no penalty for the Jews rising up against anyone that rises up against them. In which case, why even give us the first shot? We're just saying make a war in Shushan. The whole thing is basically weird now. But it does mean the Gentiles have to think twice as to what they're saying. Today I'm going to sell you the fish and tomorrow I'm going to slit your throat. Not so fast. You know, you could slit my throat, but maybe I'll slit yours first and I'll get away with it. That's what's really changing in Shushan now. Now, there was a problem, therefore, of social unrest, which Ahasuerus didn't like the idea of. So to prevent an uprising specifically in Shushan, which was now more prone to a riot than anywhere else, because it wasn't clear anyone else what was going, the king let his subjects know that he fully endorsed these second letters. The couriers went out stunned in haste by order of the king. That's opposed to the first letters in 3:15, chapter 3:15, when it said they ran out hastily at the order of the king. Didn't say they were stunned. Now the laws enacted in Shushan only after its residents had seen all the couriers going out stunned and in haste. That's why the events are mentioned in order there. They went out and the law was enacted in Shushan. In order to instill fear of the Jews into all those present in Shushan, as soon as the law was enacted, Mordechai went out. And Mordechai went out, next verse 15, from before the king in a royal apparel of, this is sometimes translated as white, of Tchelis, which is sky blue. It's really very pale green. Chur is a very, very pale green, like a white green, with a large golden crown and a cloak of fine linen and deep red. Argaman is deep red. It's mistranslated as pur pur adoma, deep, deep red. And people read pur pur as purple. It is not purple. It is an extremely deep maroon, which is also a royal colour. So he was wearing tchelis, which is like sky blue, and he was wearing like a very pale green, white and maroon. And the town of Shushan was jubilant and happy. Jubilant and happy. Interesting stuff. Now it's time to have a look at the Medrash Rabbah. And there is an amazing thing on the Medrash Rabbah in Yud Aleph. That's Parsha 10.11. And it says there that Israel was victorious over its foes like a lion attacking a flock of sheep, who smites as it goes, with none able to rescue the victims from its clutches. Just like the Emperor Hadrian said to Rabbi Yehoshua, great is the sheep, i.e. Israel, that survives amongst the 70 wolves, who are the nations of the world, but still greater is the shepherd who rescues the sheep and destroys the wolves. That's what Hadrian said to Rabbi Yehoshua, praising God. Now, what's really amazing is the Eitz Yosef, which is a commentary on the Medrash, says, in no other situation do we ever find that the Jews were instructed by the decree of Gentiles themselves to wreak vengeance upon the enemies of Israel. You don't see a goy writing a decree to the Jews saying, raise up and kill anyone that's hurt you. That's extremely unusual. Now, Rabbi Aaron Kotler, in the Mishnas Reb Aaron 381, says the miracle of Purim contained no openly miraculous event, but the long chain and all of its various components could only be described as miraculous to the unprejudiced mind. Never before, and he's quoting the Eitz Yosef here and what I've just said, never before had the Jews without land or protector cowered before the majority of populations of 127 provinces across the vast empire facing annihilation. Never before had an inexplicable turn of events caused those countless enemies to be terrified before the small number of exiled minority Jews who now rose to defeat and dominate them. Never is that. It's just so weird that these Jews just turn up in little pockets and start slaughtering Gentiles en masse at a Gentile king's behest. Now, truly, God's face was not visible in Purim, but he was. Yeah, you're right. You can't point to that and go, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's doing a big miracle like he's splitting the sea or something. But the divine orchestration of the nature of these events was clear for all to see. Every common and natural event had become a monument to God's might over the political situation of what was going on. It was absolutely clear. How is it that the Goyim in Shushan didn't have some kind of bloodbath? The answer is, says the Yaffe Anaf and the Eitz Yosef, that God miraculously disabled the enemies of the Jews by instilling in them a paralyzing fear similar to a flock of sheep who make no attempt to fend off an attacking lion despite his absolute determination to kill them. That's why the Medrash says that the Jews were victorious like a lion amongst sheep. Why didn't the sheep run away? They just stood there like, you know, like a bunny in headlights or a deer in headlights, absolutely petrified. That was God's doing as well. Just like in the time of Egypt, when Moshe told the Jews, take a lamb and tie it to your bedpost for 3 days, and 3 days later you're going to... But that was nobody knew, the Jews didn't know, that that wouldn't cause a riot. That's today like a prophet saying, take a crucifix and a Quran and put it in your bay window with a note saying to be publicly burned in 72 hours. And all Jews of faith had to do it, not knowing that Christians and Muslims wouldn't arise against them. Would you do it if you were told to? Would you take a crucifix and a Quran? and put up that note in your front window saying to be burnt, think about what the BBC would say about that. That's exactly what the Jews had to do. They didn't know that God was going to paralyze the local Gentile population with terror, not to touch them. They did it because Moshe Rabbeinu told them, which was a tremendous act and merit for them. Why was it merit? Because they didn't know. The Jews of Shushan didn't know that the Gentiles weren't going to rise up against them. They assumed, essentially, every man, woman, and child was now fighting for their lives on Purim Day. You know, at least now we can fight back. That's what's different. We're allowed to fight back. What they didn't know was, is that God had terrified the Gentiles of Shushan, and the Jews could literally rampage ad infinitum. Nothing was going to stop them. Amazing. Now, I'd like to finish off. Remember we did this amazing thing about every single thing that Mordechai did, he got paid back, except for tearing of his clothing for Benjamin? There's something here. We say here that Mordechai went out from before the king in royal apparel of blue and green or white, with a large golden crown and a cloak of fine linen, and deep red, and the town of Shushan was jubilant and happy. It's very interesting. When a Kodesh Baruch Hu decides that he's going to do this salvation, a lot of things are happening here. God never deprives any creature of his due reward. Even the frogs in Egypt, which jumped into the ovens, they survived. Even dogs that didn't bark against Israel got the mitzvah that non-kosher meat has to be thrown to them. In the Torah, we have a deraisa mitzvah to throw trace meat to dogs because they didn't wet their tongue against the Jews. Anyone that serves God, got to get payback. That's why he gave Mordechai a taste of the fruit of his labor in this world, and he still kept the majority for Olam Habah. Now, because Mordechai went into the streets of the city in sackcloth, which was verse 4, 1, God gave him a royal garment, which was, he was clothed by none other than the king himself. We talked about this in the sixth chapter, right? When he was being paraded about on a horse. And in reward for the ashes that he sprinkled on his head, a royal crown was placed on his head. That was in 6:8. And in recognition of his going out to the streets on foot, Mordechai was led through the streets on a horse that was ridden by the king. And as a reward for Mordechai, with great and bitter cry, Haman was made to call out in front of him, this is what will be done to the man who wishes to honor the king, or the Kishwa king wishes to honor. But Mordechai couldn't really fully rejoice on that. You see, what did he do right after that? What did we say he did right after that finished and he took off the crown? He went straight back in sackcloth and went back fasting and wailing. So it was a very, very temporary gift, right? And anyway, that honour was extremely transient. It was only done for a few moments so the king could publicise Mordechai so that hopefully anyone that had information about the supposed plot by Haman and Esther against him would come forward and tell him. It was only done very temporarily. But now, in 8:6:15, it's a bit different. They had complete security that was ensured through the mighty acts of redemption that God has done. And once Israel was saved, Mordechai indeed could rejoice with a full heart, and he didn't go back sitting in sackcloth. The honour granted to Mordechai is now everlasting. He actually got to wear a crown, and he got to wear royal garments, and they weren't taken off. Mordechai had not what about the thing with the torn clothes? Remember, God didn't pay him back the thing when he tore his clothes in shock. God says, sorry, that goes back to Benjamin, because the cup was found in Benjamin's backpack, and all the brothers tore their clothes. That has to go on account. That has to go on account. So I'm not going to pay you back with something about not tearing, because you owe that for shave at Benjamin. We did that at the time. Now, Mordechai had not torn his clothes or had them replaced with new garments, because his ancestor, Benjamin, had caused his brothers to tear their garments, which we discussed. But Mordechai was fully rewarded for every aspect of his humility, so that even his torn clothes were replaced. Now he got new garments of white and blue and deep purple and fine linen to go against the tearing. God says, listen, now you've paid off Benjamin, I can pay you fully off. He's fixed up Shevet Benjamin, you've done great. So you know what? I'll pay you up. So as a reward for him going out into the streets in the city in sackcloth, now he's going to wear royal apparel, and a Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to make sure he's going to be looked after. And he went out dressed in a cloak of fine linen and deep red, and that covered him completely, making him appear very, very illustrious. And then the merit of his great and bitter cry, everyone was screaming in joy in Shushan. Instead of the woe and everyone crying for 3 days and screaming and wailing like Tisha B'Av, now they're joyfully screaming in the streets, and they're all proclaiming Mordechai. So the town is completely jubilant and transformed. That's why the town of Shushan in 315 was bewildered. And now the place was transformed that it became jubilant and happy. The Gentiles of Shushan were threatening their Jews by telling them, tomorrow we're going to strangle you and plunder all your money. That's what he said in the Medrash Rabbah, right? God reversed the situation, so the residents of Shushan were happy to witness Israel's greatness, and God caused Mordechai to find favor in the eyes of all the residents, and they rejoiced in him, the Goyim, very similar to the way Moshe Rabbeinu and Yosef HaTzadik were greatly esteemed in the eyes of the local mitzvim in their particular time. Moshe Rabbeinu was incredibly esteemed. The Torah actually goes on record to say that the mitzvim found, Pharaoh didn't, but all the mitzvim were like, whatever Moshe said went. Now you might, just to finish off, and then we'll do verses 16 and 17 next time, you might think that Shushan was jubilant and happy, and that means only the Jews. Only the Jews were happy. That's why it says, to the Jews there was light. In verse 16, to the Jews there was light, happiness and joy. That's true. The famous La Yehudim ha'isa ora v'simcha v'sason v'yikar. That's true. La Yehudim, to the Jews, that's true. But it's when it says La Yehudim, there's like a note on there. So that particular way that we sing it, it says not only were the Jews happy, but all the residents of Shushan, the Jews experienced light, but everyone was happy for the Jews. Everyone was like, wow, it's amazing what's the turnabout that's happened for them. Even the Gentiles understood, because the Gentiles in Shushan knew what was going on, just what a change there was for the Jews. Even they were like shocked, while they were now scared of the Jews' vengeance. We'll talk next time about verses 16 and 17, about what's happening in the actual change of the way the Jews in Shushan were going around Shushan, and how this all tied back into the feast. Because remember, the feast was in Shushan. It was very much a Shushan sin. And we'll link that in as well. And that finishes off this perek. And then, Be'ez Hashem, we can see what's going out. And the king's command reached all the other destinations in the ninth perek, how that undid what was going on outside of Shushan. Which, of course, gives us a deeper appreciation as to the fact that we keep Shushan Purim as a separate event. Because it really was in those days. It was a completely different feel and vibe in the streets there than it was in the other 126 provinces. So please God, we'll finish off the eighth perek next time and then go into the ninth perek. And as I say, really the ninth perek is kind of the end because the tenth perek is only three psukim of praise. So really it's all kind of the tie-up in the ninth perek. And I look forward to seeing you then. Thank you very, very much for taking out your time. And if there's any questions, now's the time.